Hello, my friends, and welcome to Take a Deep Breath. My name is Mike Mayer. I'm a breathwork coach, and I'm also the host of this podcast. And today I have a really interesting guest for you. His name is Nick Heath, and he's a science writer. He's a PhD, and he's known to many as the breathing diabetic. And that title already got me very curious, like, what the hell is going on here? And so today we are exploring all things breathwork. So don't worry, if you're not a diabetic, this is still super relevant for you. But if you have diabetes, might have diabetes, have family members with diabetes, then you're really going to want to dial into this episode as well. I had no idea about the connection between diabetes and poor breathing. I'd heard little bits, but to the level that he explains it in here and what's going on with why we've got extra sugar in our blood when we breathe poorly and what's going on there and insulin resistance and loads of other stuff. Nick's a load of fun. I geeked out a lot with him. He's into the science, but he's got a really good sense of humour. He's really smooth with it. And it was just a really, really fun conversation, which I cannot wait for you to get stuck into. And if you do like breathing, which I think you probably do, then down below, I've just linked you to my kind of free ebook PDF, which is 7 essential breathing techniques. 7 of my favourite breathing techniques, which can help us in a jiffy, in a jam. So if we're trying to get some sleep or unblock our nose, all these different things I've learned from all these different experts, I've just popped 7 of them down. So it's really digestible. So you can click on that, get that straight away. Okay, so on now with my new friend, the breathing diabetic. Cheers. Well, Nick, welcome to the Take a Deep Breath podcast. I'm so honoured to have you on here, aka the breathing diabetic. How are you, first of all? How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great, thanks, and I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate your time. Can't wait to get stuck into all this. The whole thing around diabetes and the breath. I don't have diabetes, but some of my family do, and so I'm really looking forward to sharing this with them afterwards and go, right, have a look at some of this. So maybe if we can start off with just a little bit about you, really. So what led you to talk a bit about the diabetes? What led you to the breathing? If you could just give us a bit of an overview, that'd be really helpful. Then we can kind of get stuck into some of the individual bits.
Okay, yeah. So I'm a type 1 diabetic. I'm 36 now, but I got diagnosed at age 11. So type 1 is the autoimmune version. So they don't really know the cause of it. Something triggers it. My body starts destroying its own insulin producing cells. And so I'm stuck with it for life. So that's kind of been a part of my life as far as I can remember, just dealing with diabetes, insulin, testing my blood sugar and stuff like that. But the breathing aspect actually came in much later, probably, I guess, technically around 2015, 2016, I got introduced to Wim Hof, like many people, right? You get obsessed with his charisma and his energy level. And I can get into lots of background on my professional career, but I was doing my postdoc. And so I was really like science minded doing all this stuff. And this was like my spiritual outlet to go do the Wim Hof method and feel all these euphoric feelings and things like that, stuff I'd never really experienced. And so I became obsessed with it. Like every day it was Wim Hof, Wim Hof, Wim Hof, Wim Hof. And, and over time, I have an obsessive personality, so I kind of went way overboard on it. And I ended up feeling drained. Like after about a year or so, there was days when like I would get home from work, I would have to take a nap, then I would go to my wife's yoga class, and then I'd be just drained and just want to sleep, always tired. And I'd become a habitual mouth breather, right? Things I know now, but back then I didn't realize. And it wasn't actually until I got introduced to Patrick McEwen through his work with the Oxygen Advantage. I heard him on a podcast and he was talking about breathing through your nose, breathing slower, breathing less air, all of these things that were like, okay, this goes against everything I've learned from Wim Hof, but I was feeling bad. So I said, I'm going to try it. I went and bought mouth tape. And that night was like the best night of sleep of my life. And I woke up with like an insane amount of energy. And so I started, okay, well, if that worked, I'm going to try this like light breathing. I'm going to try this like slower breathing stuff. This was in 2017, so late 2017, and it was incredible. Like the most energy I've ever had. I had all this mental like clarity and things. And so fast forward a few months and I was like, well, now my blood sugars are better. Like I'm I've had diabetes, you know, for many years at this point, and I knew the only real thing I've changed was my breathing. And I thought, well, I need to understand what's going on. And so I started getting into the science of it, like, oh, let me just look around. I'm not a pulmonologist or a respiratory physiologist, but I'm just going to like look on some of the papers. And then sure enough, you start seeing like, oh, slow breathing helps with diabetes, autonomic nervous system, this. And so I just started reading and reading, and that led me down a never ending rabbit hole that I'm still in today. I can't get out of. It's just become so like, it's such an intricate part of my life and just such a passion to share this stuff. Like, I just wanted to share it. I was like, no one's ever told anyone with diabetes they could just breathe different. It could help. So I went and did Patrick's training just to kind of like further my own education, and developed a relationship with Patrick there about diabetes and, you know, trying to apply breathing for diabetes there. And then, yeah, I've kind of rambled here, but from then on, I've just become obsessed with breathing, all aspects of it, really, the science, the spirit, everything around it, and trying to take some of the science and some of the things that are out there and translate them into practical, simple things people can do to help their life and hopefully be as changed as I was, right? Because I was just like, to this day, I still practice every day, and it's like truly one of the most like simplest but most profound tools you can come across is the breath. Yeah. And I don't have to convince you, but people listening maybe would like to hear it again.
That's so cool. If you love breathing as much as I do, then you probably already know that breath work is one of the fastest ways we can change our state. So we can induce feelings of concentration and focus. We can make ourselves relax. We can fall asleep. We can lower blood pressure, improve heart rate variability, improve lower back pain, and so many other things. But there's so much out there, right? There's so many contradictory methods. There's probably thousands of breathing techniques out there. There's hundreds of different people talking about breath work right now. It's getting really popular. And so it can be quite daunting to know where to start. Well, look, I've interviewed about 100 of the world's top experts now. I've got a whole podcast dedicated to it. So if you want to get stuck into those, absolutely can do. And you can learn like I've learned. Or for those of you out there that are thinking, do you know what? I just want to know the information that's bespoke to me right now. Then I actually take on one-on-one clients. So I only take on a very, very small amount of clients each month. And I build a package that's just for you. So we start off by doing your breath assessments. I will run through about 5 different ways that I can measure your breath. So we'll get a really good view of your chemistry, of your mechanics, of your nervous system, your sleep, really build a beautiful picture about what's going on with you right now. Then we look at your goals. Where are you trying to get to? What is it you really would like? If I could wave a magic wand for you right now, and you could get anything by using the breath, what would it be? And then we look at those two things, and then I help you then get that by building your own bespoke breath coaching package. So it's very exclusive. It's only a couple of people. It's direct access, one-on-one. They book up fast. So if you'd like to have a complimentary breath consultation with me, see if you'd be a good fit, then click on the link below. There's a small questionnaire to complete, and then we can jump on Zoom, have a chat, and if it's a good fit, then we can get stuck into your bespoke breath coaching plan. Thank you so much for listening. Now back on with the podcast.
It's lovely to just see some of the parallels in journey, because I was listening to like Joe Rogan in 2015, 2016, this guy called Wim Hof. Wim Hof, just his name kept coming up, and listened to the podcast, and then it's like, holy shit, what's going on with this guy? And it was more the ice that got me interested, like cold. I was terrified of the cold. And then, you know, went out to Poland, spent a week with him. And then I've got a video coming out soon where it's like, I was a breath junkie. So that's kind of the title I'm playing with it. So I got addicted to those feelings. And I remember like every day before work, I would sit in my car because I came back and still had a corporate job. And I would just hyperventilate as hard as I could for as long as I could, try and get those feelings again of the tingles and stuff, and go to work. And I was on this almost hamster wheel of it. And then as the pandemic then hit, I then came across Patrick, and I was like, same. I was like, oh, that's weird. He's like saying the opposite of Wim. That doesn't make any sense. And I had no real idea about breathing. I just thought there was like box breathing and Wim Hof breathing. I didn't know there was any, all this other stuff. And then I did Patrick's course, and and then I started to feel better as well. So I don't have the diabetes, but stress and anxiety was my flavor of suffering. And the Wim Hof thing, you know, this is not Wim Hof, this is just hyperventilation, so I'm not having to go at any particular method, but I always found it would give me a couple of minutes of relief, but then nothing ever changed. And so did you, when you were, you so you're looking at your blood sugar levels, I guess, during the OA stuff. Were you looking at them during the hyperventilation stages? Did anything change when you were doing hyperventilation? Did it get better, worse, or was anything noticed there?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I wasn't as into it. Like, I wasn't looking at it from the diabetic perspective then, because as I mentioned, it was kind of like a spiritual thing for me. Yeah. I want to piggyback on something you said, not going after the Wim Hof method, right?
Yeah.
I overdid it. Like, it was my fault, not Wim's instructions at all. Very similar personality there. But in reality, like, I think it helped overall with my blood sugars a little bit, just because of the mindset, right? I felt like I had more control over my life. Like, you know, Wim gave me that, like, it gave me this sense of like, oh, I take command, you know, you're the pilot, all these things. I was like, I got this. So I think it gave me more confidence to take better control of my blood sugar and stuff. And so that's great. And that's a valuable aspect of what Wim teaches, is that mindset component of you have more control over your nervous system than you think, or your mind, and all of these different things. So I think that helped. And I remember, you know, I was in good numbers back then. It wasn't like I was off the rails with my diabetes or anything, but it was so noticeable with Patrick's breathing techniques that it made me rethink all of it. And so that's kind of what got me into it. And I do want to say, like you mentioned, you know, you don't have diabetes and stress and anxiety, but that's really what it comes down to. Sometimes I don't even like to mention diabetes, because it's the same mechanism. It's like the same processes for everyone, right? The reason it helps diabetes is the same reason it helps anyone. It's the same reason it would help with COPD or asthma or all these. It's like, you know, reducing stress, improving blood flow, improving the balance of the nervous system. It's just that diabetes happens to exacerbate all of those things, right? Like anxiety, depression. We have way higher rates of all these different things. And so just like you, like, I had a lot of stress and anxiety. I put a lot of pressure on myself all the time, and was always stressed over something. And breathing gave me a way to kind of like bring that down once I learned these slower parasympathetic dominant states, and bring me some balance. Right. But yeah,
beautiful. I often describe the Wim Hof method now as like a beautiful gateway drug to breath work, you know, because so many people woke up to breath work because of that guy and what he's achieved. And so I'm entirely grateful for that. And then I think that then it's the curiosity of, well, what else is out there? What else can I do and change my state? So, no. So can you help me? And please feel free to geek out here with the science. Don't hold back or anything, because we can break it apart a little bit. I'm really curious now. How is breathing helping the diabetes? What is going on? What are the mechanisms that's going on? How is slow breathing doing this? If you can just give us a helicopter view, and then maybe we can jump into some of it.
Yeah. So the big one is stress, right? So when you have a stress response, your body releases cortisol, it releases more sugar into your blood, right? Stored glucose, and your blood sugars rise. It can also impact your insulin sensitivity. And if you do this in a chronic state, right, if you're always chronically stressed, it can lead to lots of basically negative metabolic effects with how you process glucose and how sensitive you are to insulin. And so on a big level, that's what we're doing. We're learning to turn off that stress response. And people with diabetes are in a constant state of stress. So there's like the actual stress of blood sugar fluctuations, which is a nightmare, causing like oxidative stress, inflammation, and a chronic sympathetic state. So a chronic fight or flight state. And so that kind of just wreaks havoc on our nervous systems. And so when you learn to downregulate that, even for brief periods, you know, 10, 20 minutes in the morning, it's, you know, accumulates over time, and you start to lower your baseline sympathetic state some. And this shows up in like heart rate variability or whatever, you know, measure you want to take of the state of your cardio autonomic nervous system. But in general, by reducing stress, right, we're lowering that burden of diabetes. Like, we're reducing all of those hazards we get with diabetes, that the complications, all of that, all the risks of it, by just taking our foot off the gas for a little bit and a little bit more on the brake using that parasympathetic nervous system. And when we think about like this, like some of the papers that have shown that, a lot of it is with the nervous system. So it shows like people with diabetes, they like, let's say, have a higher baseline sympathetic state, which shows up as much lower heart rate variability than an age match control. So if you and I were the same age, right, if they took my heart rate variability, it's probably going to be less than yours just because diabetes has messed with my nervous system so much. When you learn to start breathing slowly and upregulate the tone of your vagus nerve, which we can, you know, chat about for a little bit, but basically the main nerve of your parasympathetic nervous system, you start to increase your heart rate variability. So you get to at least maybe not completely reverse, but counteract a little bit of those negative effects of diabetes. Another big one is like blood flow. People with diabetes have reduced blood flow. We have issues like cardiovascular disease is unfortunately one, you know, like the number one killer of people with diabetes. So if you can do anything to, you know, protect your vascular tone, it's really beneficial. And of course, breathing helps with that, right? When you relax everything, relax, you know, get into that parasympathetic state, your blood vessels relax, it reduces blood pressure, it increases blood flow. And this can help with, you know, hopefully reducing some of your risks of complications there. So that's a few, I kind of rambled. So I'll see if you got any follow-ups and then
Dude, you're not rambling. This is amazing. Honestly, please don't hold back. Just like I say, I'm looking forward to properly geeking out on this. So this is the bit I'd love to learn a bit more. So why, when we're stressed, are we releasing glucose and insulin? What are the mechanisms that are causing that? And what's our body trying to do by doing that?
It's preparing you, right? It's like getting you ready for some sort of action. It's saying, okay, you're about to run. It's the fight or flight, right? You need to be prepared for whatever's going to happen. So your liver releases stored glucose, and then it's basically, I don't remember the exact reason why your insulin sensitivity in some places actually goes down, which is interesting. You'd think you would want better insulin sensitivity. Mm-hmm. I've heard some good justification, but I don't remember at this moment, so I'm not gonna to try to pretend like I remember. But essentially, you're preparing yourself for movement. And when you don't do that movement, right, when you are just sitting at your desk stressed out, or if it's just because of your actual diabetes, like for example, sometimes I call, you know, to refill a prescription and I find out, oh, my insurance denies it or something. And this happens more frequently than like you would believe for someone with diabetes for 24 years or whatever it is now, 25 years. It never gets easy, right? And my body floods my system with adrenaline. Like, this is BS. You know, I get really angry and think. And so just those stressors, right, of the disease itself can trigger this fight or flight state, not to mention all the other physiology going on with diabetes. So when this happens, right, it increases our blood sugar. And if you do this sustained over time, it's going to be have negative long-term like complications and things with diabetes.
I've never had that explained like that before. That's really useful. So when we get stressed, the liver is releasing more glucose because it wants more energy in the blood. So if we need to run away, we've got all that extra fuel released ready to go, but we don't run away. We sit down, we stew on it. Then the body has to release insulin to deal with that rise in sugar. So it's almost like we've eaten some Skittles or something in that sense. Again, I'm butchering this. Please tell me if I get this wrong. So then now we're dealing with all this this insulin because of the stress, because of the sugar that's been released. And then that's like that roller coaster ride of insulin sugar going on. And so we need to get out of stress for many reasons, but one of them is that. Okay. So when we then... How do you measure? Is there a reliable measurement for somebody being stressed? Like, how can we tell someone's in sympathetic, parasympathetic, what that levels look like? How do they do that scientifically? Is there one method, or are there multiple ways to do that?
There's multiple ways for sure. Like if you measured cortisol, right? Because that's the hormone. That's one of the hormones. Mm-hmm. Several hormones, but that stress hormones. But that's one that's kind of a nice one that everyone kind of knows and has heard of. So if you measured cortisol, like I think they can do it through your saliva or blood measurements are always the best. Mm-hmm. And then more indirect measures are heart rate variability, like heart rate variability or something called the baroreflex sensitivity. But heart rate variability is generally the one used most often because it's non-invasive. You can just, you know, put a strap around your chest and check your heart rate variability, which is the beat to beat interval. So the time between each heartbeat, we shouldn't be beating at a metronome, right? There's these little changes and it's a reflection of your ability to adapt to your environment. Like everything is always changing all around us. And so your heart rate is constantly adjusting based on if you moved a little, this or that. And a lot of this is regulated through your vagus nerve, your parasympathetic nervous system. Mm-hmm. And so when they measure the heart rate variability, they can say, this person is in a stress state or this person's in a relaxed state. And if they're in a relaxed state, their heart rate variability will be very high. And if they're in a more stressed state, their heart rate variability will be much lower. Mm-hmm. And so with people with diabetes, you know, there's not like there's thousands of research studies with breathing, you know, it's unfortunate, sure. But in general, heart rate variability does get measured a lot in different contexts. So we can at least know that at baseline, when a diabetic comes into a study, their heart rate variability is generally lower at mm-hmm. rest than a counterpart that doesn't have diabetes. And so this tells us our bodies are stressed over something. Now that which aspect of diabetes is it, the emotional side? Is it the actual blood sugar fluctuations? It's probably different for every individual, right? Because these are all averages of different things. So each person's got their own unique set of basically issues with diabetes that are causing that problem, but that's how they measure it. Usually it's heart rate variability, but they, you know, with the breathing stuff, they see it with cortisol, like baseline cortisol goes down when people do diaphragmatic breathing for like 3 or 4 weeks, you know, every day for just a few minutes, like 20 minutes a day or 15 minutes a day. So there's lots of nice studies showing that the slow breathing does help reduce or counteract some of that stress. So that's usually how it's measured though.
Yeah. And so you mentioned the chest strap. What do you measure your HRV? What devices would you recommend?
So that goes a little beyond my expertise to recommend one, because I don't know the science behind it, how they're the QAQC part of it. Sure. But I know there are like polar chest straps and things like that, that people use. So I'm pretty sure those are the most reliable. Mm-hmm. I don't want to name any brands, but I've tried different things and that aren't a chest strap, like a watch or a finger thing or different stuff. And then I've recommended them actually, cause this is awesome. I get to see it. And maybe that's okay for you, like just to see your own trends. But then I've come across studies where, you know, when they actually put them up to the test against a chest strap, they don't really do as well. So you really need a chest strap. I've never actually gone that far on myself, to be honest. I was using the super non-invasive ones. And, so I don't know if my absolute numbers where they ranked up with different people, but I could definitely see changes. Like, for example, when I got COVID and my heart rate variability plummeted for like afterward too, like it was quite a while after I saw it go down. And so just being able to see those relative changes, at least let me know, okay, my body's still fighting something right now.
Wow. Okay. That's cool. Yeah. I'm still playing with like, which I really want to have it. I really want to get a device, but because of the amount that's out there, I'm just in the paralysis of it. It's like, oh, I've heard that this ring does this, but this whoopee thing does this. And I'm like, oh. Anyway. Slow breathing then. So this is, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. So when I take clients through breathing protocols, OA, Buteyko, those sort of things, I often describe it, and I got this from my friend Tom Granger, it's a bit like telling somebody to eat their greens sometimes, because there's relaxing breathing techniques and then there's some of these more slower ones which are a bit uncomfortable, you know. Let's say, for example, long breath holds. Now, we can bring a state of relaxation as we're doing that, but typically, let's say we're doing like what they do in the OA, which is like maximum breathlessness tests. Like, how many steps can a human do before they need to take another breath? That's not a very nice exercise, and we're starting to push our limits a little bit there, but really good. It gives a really lovely metric. So is there a line between like a slow, gentle, relaxing breathing exercise, let's say coherence breathing? If we start to get so low, do we start to increase stress? And is there a danger then that, at least in the short term, we're starting to get into that stress territory? Although then if we zoom out, we are helping the body adjust to like a slow breathing technique. So I'm just trying to understand like that scale of slow breathing to the point where does it get too slow?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So most of the time when I mention the word slow breathing, I'm thinking more of like the coherent breathing, you know, around, let's say, 4 to 7 breaths a minute for most people. In that general ballpark, usually it's like 5 to 6 is what most people find most comfortable. So that's about a 5 or 6 second inhale or a 5 or 6 second exhale. I personally like to teach people a little bit longer exhale. So maybe a 4 second inhale and a 6 second exhale, just because that can be a little bit more relaxing for most people. But that's kind of the sweet spot. There's lots of different ways to achieve it. Thinking of it as like green vegetables is a really good idea. Like you can eat broccoli or kale or, you know, or cabbage or whatever. They're all going to be good for you in a slightly different reason. That's kind of what these slow breathing, like box breathing or 4-7-8 or 6-2-7, you can get all these different ratios, but they're all kind of doing the same thing. And that's activating that parasympathetic nervous system, activating the relaxation response, which is going to basically counter all the damage from the stress response. As you go down slow, right? Like you stop breathing and you hold your breath, it becomes a kind of a dose response thing. Like how often are you doing it? How intense are you doing it? And those will kind of dictate whether you get benefits or kind of too much stress from the practices. So things like breath holds actually could be really helpful in a person with diabetes because of that stress response, that like what you just mentioned, you're adapting your body to stress. And that stress response I mentioned earlier, right? That we said, oh, that's the bad guy. It's really not that bad. It's actually a really great thing. It does a lot of incredible things. If it's short, if it's very brief, it can be really beneficial. And in fact, our bodies need it. Like we need that stress response. It's when it's sustained over a really long time that it can cause all these negative side effects. So if you can go out and do a breath hold practice, for example, like an oxygen advantage or something like that, where you're doing, you know, maybe 3 to 5 pretty strong breath holds in a safe way, like, you know, you're measuring you're using a pulse oximeter to measure your oxygen saturation to make sure it's not getting too low. That could be beneficial. Again, if each person's individual, you want to work with a coach or something, you don't just want to go out and start holding your breath and pass out, but it can be really helpful because of the adaptations to that stress. Like, for example, one thing, if you lower your blood oxygen saturation, your body says we need more oxygen, right? So what does it do? Well, it releases nitric oxide to open the blood vessels to increase blood flow. It says, I can't get more oxygen, but I could get you more blood. So here, I'm going to release more nitric oxide, open up those blood vessels. And wherever I sense that there's low oxygen, I'm going to, you know, really push the blood faster through there. And so again, for a person with diabetes, that could be really helpful. It, you know, it also helps like with your immune system and all these different things that these little intermittent hypoxic training programs can do. So, but it's a dose. Like you just got to make sure if I woke up and my blood sugar was like 200, which is high for me, it would not be smart for me to go put myself under a hypoxic stress breath test, you know, breathing and do like 10 breath holds, because the acute stress of it will raise my blood sugar slightly most of the time. But it would be a little counterproductive at that point. But let's say my blood sugar is in great range, I'm feeling good. Maybe I could go do a breath hold training, like, you know, do 3 or 5 of these stronger breath holds, and it might raise my blood sugar a little bit, but the positive adaptations from it are probably worth it to get that kind of like, you know, you gotta pick and choose your battles. Of course, it won't be perfect, but it might be worth doing some of those more intense stressful breathing techniques. So it's a balancing act. And the problem is, like, you think of things like obstructive sleep apnea, like, well, aren't they just holding their breath? Why is it so bad? Because it's chronic, right? It's over and over all night long. And so everything comes back to kind of like a sweet spot of dose response. And so if you do these stressor kind of breath holds, the super slow breathing, we might call it, where you might breathe once every minute or something, you just have to be careful not to overdo it.
Yeah, I think it's really important, isn't it? It's like listening to your body. I often say, you know, there's like good, like you said, there's good stressors and bad stressors. Like going to the gym's like a stressor, right? You know, going to lift some weights, we're like in a state of stress temporarily, but we don't lift a dumbbell 24 hours a day, because that would be crazy.
But that's what we do with our bodies, right? That's a good analogy. Like it's like a 24-hour dumbbell, because we're always something, right? There's always something to be stressed about. And so,
Well, do you do anything with movement, either on yourself or with your clients, when it comes to like stress reduction?
So for myself, 100%. I mean, I love walking. I'm a huge advocate of walking. I ruck. I don't know if you've heard of rucking before. Back in 2018, my brother convinced me to do a 50-mile ruck where it's a, you wear a weighted backpack. So, it's like a 20-pound weight, 20 to 40 pounds, but I'm usually at about 20 pounds. And you just walk, with a weighted backpack. It's that simple. But, so it's, I really like it. It's so good for my mind and it's good for my insulin sensitivity. It's good for my blood sugars most of the time. So like, if I go out and just do like 30 minutes or an hour, it really helps my blood sugars. Mm-hmm. If I go for like 6 hours, it's way, you know, counterproductive at that point. But so I am a huge fan of encouraging people to walk and move and things like that for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't try to prescribe any type of exercise regime just because I think everyone's different. You know, it's up to what works for a person. If they already have a gym routine or if they like swimming, you know, I always think enjoyment, like focus on enjoyment, whatever you can find, even with breathing, like find things that actually you are looking forward to doing. That way you'll do it rather than like, this is what this one science paper said, so you have to do this one, right? Like, it's like, there's so much flexibility out there when you start to look at what works for people. Just focus on what you enjoy. So if there's any kind of movement, do it more. And then with the breathing too, like, hey, which one actually resonates with you? Like, I know this one said, I'm telling you, this one's really healthy, but is this one, if this one is more, like you said, like even Wim Hof, like if that's a gateway for you to want to, you know, realize this power of our breathing that we have, go for it. Like, I'm not going to tell someone not to do anything as long as they're happy doing it and they're safe about it.
Yeah. Oh, you're a really nice man. You're really chilled about all this. You've got a really nice perspective.
Well, that's because I've gone through a lot of dogmatic periods in my life and I'm always proven wrong. Literally anything I think of, it's like, it's, well, here's another study that shows this. And so it just comes down to like principles, right? Like I can be 100% confident telling people that slow breathing is healthy for most people. Like, I feel really good about that. There's almost no dangers. But if I was to say 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out is the best technique, that's a joke, right? It's like that. So I've just learned like, people have their own preferences and there's a reason for that. And I think each person kind of knows what their body needs. Like, we both, maybe we really needed Wim Hof. Like, we needed that in our life to make us realize we didn't need it. Like, to realize we need Patrick. And so I think when someone's like, really, like, I get a lot of people asking me about Wim Hof. That's like one of the most common questions. And I just say, if you really want to do it, just do it safely. Like, as a diabetic, I would tell you not to do it. When it's people with diabetes, I would say start with the slow side. And then when your nervous system's ready, go for it. But I also know that like, if someone told me that, I would say, well, screw you, I'm going to do it immediately. You know, like we all have our own issues in our minds. So I just try to be open to whatever will get someone excited about breathing is what matters most.
It's so funny because I have the exact same conversations with clients. It's like, we need to get your foundation sorted. You know, we need to really work on that. So I never tell people what to do. I was like, consider pausing the hyperventilation stuff for a bit. Let's get your foundation lovely and strong and you sleep right. And then you can, you know, implement it. But then some people do find a nice relief huffing and puffing for 10 minutes, you know, a couple of times. I do it so rarely now. Like, when I've got a migraine, I'll do some Wim Hof-esque. That seems to clear it up really nicely. And then rarely, I might do like one conscious connected breathing session a year. I'll go to an event and, you know, huff and puff for like an hour. And it's lovely. You know, it's a great,
of course, great thing.
Have you gone down that route? Have you done any big hyperventilation sessions anywhere?
So no, not like an actual like structured one. I've done the Wim Hof, you know, for an hour or so, like where you just continuously do his technique. Because again, not in a smart way. Like I saw like a video where he was teaching, this was a long time ago, people like 2016, saw a video where he was leading people through it. And he said, you know, we did this for an hour. And I thought, oh, you can do it for an hour. Okay. I'm doing it. It's like the next day, you know, I'm going to sit here for an hour and do it. Yeah. And then I did read a book. This was before I found Patrick. So this must've been early 2017. I found a book called Shamanic Breathing or Shamanic Breathwork by Linda Starr. And again, it was like the spiritual side. I was like, okay, this is interesting. And she had a guided CD with it. So I like shut all my curtains. I put a face mask on and laid down on a bed and went through that. But it was, again, very unsafe how I did it. So I don't recommend that.
Sure. Sure.
But, yeah, so I've never gone to a conscious connected breathwork session or anything.
It's very, I mean, I did Rebirth in last year at a festival. It was all very safe. There was plenty of people watching and supporting. But that was your head in water with a snorkel on while doing the conscious connected breathing, while they're playing the womb noise and the water's your body. It was a whole crazy scenario where your brain basically thinks you're a baby again. It's a very bizarre thing for another time. But yeah, interesting. Yeah, so
I've read about the holotropic breathing a lot. Like, yeah. I read the book and very fascinated by it, because it, you know, when you read the book and you realize what their intention with it was, it's really amazing, right? It's like, it's phenomenal. And then you see it translated into the world, and there's all sorts of people who just misinterpreted everything they said, right? But they had incredible intentions, and like, safety was their number one priority above everything. So it's a nice reminder, actually, like, that's where it all started. This conscious connected stuff started with holotropic, right? And they were just the most down to earth, like, practical and safe people out there. And now it's kind of exploded into this, like, just come to my studio and we're going to hyperventilate. Yes. And it's, yeah. So so I am fascinated by it. I've just never had the courage to go out and like do a 2-hour session somewhere.
Yeah, I think some of the holotropic ones, I think, are like 4 hours as well. And because I interviewed one of the instructors a little while ago, and she says that the role of the sitter, because the safety is so important, is their job is just to sit there and support for sometimes 4 or 5 hours. And so even when they come out of these like hyperventilation stages, they often just sit in there, and they might just sit there for an hour and they don't say anything, and then they'll just burst into tears after an hour of just sitting there. And so you've just got to hold this space, which sounds really intense. I'm coming to the US actually in October to Wyoming to do something called vivation, which is like the second oldest breathing technique, registered breathing technique. And so apparently, I might butcher the history here, so apologies anybody that knows it better than this, but there's a group of US people that went to India in like the 70s, and I think Stan was part of it. There was like Binny Dansby, who does rebirthing. There was this guy, Jim Leonard. There was Leonard Orr. There was all these people. They all went there around the same time, maybe even together. And then they all came back to the US with like these conscious connected breathing techniques that they learned. And they all went off and created these individual schools. But yeah, there's something magical about the holotropic one. Even the word, just, I don't know. It's always, I've never actually done one of those sessions, but it would be very interesting to go through that level. So talking about hyperventilation then, mouth and nose. I don't know about you. This is one of the most common questions I get asked on stuff. What's the relationship between mouth and diabetes? Is there one? And could you break that down for us a little bit? Or mouth and stress, however you think.
Sure. Yeah. So I have a very strong opinion of this, but again, I'm very open to it. But for people with diabetes, especially, nasal breathing can be one of the simplest things. I mentioned the mouth tape changing my life. Right. And I slept better. And then that helped with everything downstream of that. And it's really that nose breathing. So when we breathe through our nose, we get all sorts of benefits, right? There's the warming and humidifying, but of course our mouth does that too. But it's a little bit better from our nose, you know, supposedly. I don't know how much rigorous science has ever debated that, but our nose does the warming and humidifying, but we get nitric oxide. And that's the real 100% difference between the nose and the mouth, is getting more nitric oxide. So our paranasal sinuses are continuously producing nitric oxide. When you inhale through your nose, you bring that down into your lungs, and this opens up the blood vessels, and it allows, you know, the blood in your lungs to be redistributed so that you get better uptake, better matching of the air in the blood, more oxygen in the blood. And this translates to more oxygen in your tissue. So they've even done studies showing that when you breathe through your nose versus through your mouth, you get about 10% more oxygen in your actual tissues from the nasal breathing. So why is this important to diabetes? Well, it turns out that people with diabetes have a lot of issues with oxygen. So if they measure our pulse oximeter, if they put one on our fingers, we generally have a lower blood oxygen saturation. So we're not getting as much oxygen. And we don't get as much to the tissues because we don't have enough in our blood, for one. And the way high blood sugars affect our hemoglobin, it can actually cause the oxygen to hang on tighter to the hemoglobin, so it doesn't get released as easily. So not only are we getting less oxygen on our hemoglobin, which we're carrying around the oxygen, but it's actually harder for that oxygen to be released to the tissues. Mm. all of that's to say, like, if nasal breathing can help at all, right? 10%, 2%, whatever it is, it's definitely going to help over the mouth. It seems like a no brainer for people with diabetes to make at least that switch to nasal breathing as much as you can, just to try to counteract a little bit of those defects of diabetes having a lack of oxygen at the cellular level. And in fact, there's lots of, if you get excited about any topic in the world, you can find like a bunch of scientists who are really excited and super niched down on that one topic. But there's a group of researchers who think, you know, lack of oxygen at the cellular level is the root cause of all diabetic complications, which makes sense, right? Oxygen's our source of energy, so it makes a lot of sense. But there's lots of other things going on. So if we could even counter that at all with nasal breathing, it seems like a no-brainer. So I definitely am a huge fan of encouraging people, all people, but people with diabetes, to switch to nasal breathing as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And if it's comfortable, you know, the mouth tape at night can be a nice way to kind of a gateway, right, into the nasal breathing and to seeing the power of it. So yeah, huge fan of it.
What's going on, if you can explain a bit more? You know, you're saying that, so with diabetics, it's harder for the oxygen to get onto the hemoglobin in the first place, and it's hard to get off again. Is that right? What's causing?
Yeah, I'm not sure about getting onto it. That's a great question. So they show that we have lower oxygen saturation. So it probably, there's something going on that's causing that to happen. But getting off of it, like, yeah, getting released from the hemoglobin. So there's the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve, which is this cool little S-shaped curve that shows how different factors can impact the amount of oxygen that your hemoglobin can hold and how easy it's released from the hemoglobin. Mm-hmm. So in the breathing community, we talk a lot about the Bohr effect. So the Bohr effect is basically that if you increase carbon dioxide, you have Patrick's going to give me a hard time, a rightward shift of the oxyhemoglobin curve, which will increase release of oxygen into the cell. So by having a little bit more carbon dioxide, you get more oxygen at the tissue level. Well, when blood sugar is high, it does something to slightly shift it to the left. So it actually shifts it to hold more oxygen. It's something, some sort of damaging effect of the sugar. I don't know exactly how it does it. I don't know if like the sugar replaces some of the, you know, some of the attachment sites, probably not. I'm not quite 100%, but I know that it does shift it slightly to the left, meaning that it's making it oxygen less available to the tissues. So yeah, pretty crazy. I'll stop there. Cause the other part of it, there's another molecule going on there, but I don't know it fully, but if you get really, really high blood sugar, like super high, it can throw things off even crazier when you go into like what we call diabetic ketoacidosis. But that's for another day.
So does that mean then that, let's just talk about it without numbers, but like an average non-diabetic person needs a normal level of CO2 to help that oxygen release, lower the bond or the affinity, I think they call it. Does that mean then that a diabetic person might need a slightly higher amount of CO2 in their body versus somebody without diabetes to help that same release mechanism act normally?
That's a great thought. I would, you know, it makes common sense to me, but when you get into like the blood and all that, who knows, little changes can shift things so weird. But so I wouldn't want to say with certainty, but that's how I kind of interpreted it in my own life. So I thought, oh, when I do these slower breathing and these reduced breathing techniques where I'm increasing CO2, in my head, I'm thinking this is even more beneficial because of exactly what you just stated. Yeah. Like my hemoglobin's really holding on tight. It doesn't want to let go of that oxygen. So I'm giving it an extra nudge with a little bit more CO2. And if anything, it's just more justification to do it, to try these more reduced breathing techniques that help us utilize this Bohr effect. So even if it doesn't necessarily work 100%, like one for one that way, it seems like a no brainer just to do it, to at least get the adequate amount of CO2 to really, to help the oxygen be released.
So I guess it would be something along the lines of like the higher that somebody's Bolt score is, or for people that don't know Bolt score, the longer the slower respiratory rate you have per minute, the better. I'm guessing to a degree that for all of us anyway, but from a diabetic perspective, just really focusing on tolerance to CO2 would be quite beneficial, just to help that cellular release.
Crazy, huh?
Just the stuff I just find really interesting. So nitric oxide. So my understanding is, and please correct me, that the nasal nitric oxide only lasts for a few seconds in the lungs, but it's enough to open up the vessels and the tissue so that we get that more efficient breath, which we don't get through the mouth. So we take that breath in and everything opens up and we can bring in that extra oxygen. But then there's a different version of the nitric oxide that is going around the body, that you're saying that when our oxygen levels start to drop, it releases. Is that right? Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, so there's endothelial nitric oxide, which gets released kind of throughout all of your blood vessels. And that is, it's all nitric oxide, right? But it's like the way it's stored and things like that. And so when you breathe it through your nose, the general consensus has been for a long time that that the lifetime is too short, so it reacts too quickly. So it only has a few seconds, right? So once it gets into your lungs, it reacts too quickly to actually be taken up into the blood and actually help with downstream effects. Mm-hmm. So when we look at studies that show, for example, people inhale extra nitric oxide, they'll see systemic effects. So like they inhale extra nitric oxide, but then they'll see improvements in their leg or something like that. Like, and they've never really understood why. They thought it's something about what's happening in the lungs that is helping out. And then downstream, that's just being like, we're seeing an indirect effect of that. But more recently, it has been shown that inhaled nitric oxide does hitch a ride on the hemoglobin, through a reversible bond, which I'm going to tell you what it is, but without noting too much about it. It's called SNO-HB. So it's S nitric oxide. I forget what the S stands for. And it's riding on the hemoglobin, which is the dash HB. And so there's a couple papers in there's one paper in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences. This was in 2015 that talks really deeply about this SNO-HB. And then there was a more recent paper, I want to say 2019 or maybe a little bit even newer than that, that showed this, what I'm talking about, that when they inhaled it, it increased this SNOHB and therefore is showing the systemic effect. Like this is how it actually is getting taken up and it is being carried around your body. There's lots of we could just nerd out on what that means and if it's even applicable to nasal breathing, because they were inhaling a lot of extra nitric oxide. So is it, I'm not sure, you know, we don't know if nasal breathing is kind of doing a little bit of that and it's just not enough to notice it in measurements. That would be my guess if I was to, you know, put a wager on it, that every time we breathe through our nose, we are getting a little bit of this SNOHB. Or a little bit of it is being converted to this SNOHB, but that is really this version or the storage system of nitric oxide is how it really helps systemically. So when if you had, let's say, low oxygen in your arm, like there was some portion of your arm that wasn't getting, that had lower oxygen, this SNOHB is the version of it that can sense that hypoxia. And it can say, oh, we need to reverse back to nitric oxide, back to regular nitric oxide and be released to open up these blood vessels. And it's incredible. It's like, that's a superpower, right? Of course. I mean, our bodies are incredible, but so that is the version that actually does that. Now the endothelial, like when it's released systemically, I'm not sure if it gets stored as SNOHB or if it's just that when it's released, it just automatically opens the blood vessel. So it doesn't need that storage mechanism, you know. I've never gone too far down that rabbit hole, but I do know that like when you hold your breath, nitric oxide concentrations increase significantly. And the thought is that it's an evolutionary adaptation to protect us against periods of low oxygen.
Oh, that's freaking fascinating. I haven't heard that before. So very cool. So you've probably seen that like it's probably maybe a really misquoted study about humming and 1500% increase in nasal nitric oxide. So does that mean then, based on that theory, if we hum, then we would be taking them? Because I always thought, well, for humming, based on my old thinking just before this conversation, we would hum, more nitric oxide would come in. It would. I heard about rumors of doctors humming while they were during COVID, you know, sterilizing the air, the ones that understood it. And so I was thinking, okay, you hum, you get more nasal nitric oxide. Okay, it probably opens up the lungs a little bit more. There's more, but then it's gone. But based on that, that makes a lot more sense. You increase the nasal nitric oxide through humming, and then it goes around the body. Now, again, I know this isn't your area of expertise, but I'll just get your thoughts on this. Is that, so it's sticking to the hemoglobin. Is it then just waiting for the time it's needed? Or do you think it's...
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
So cool.
So this was fascinating with this study that showed that it stuck to the hemoglobin. That's a good way. Like, let's just call it sticking to the hemoglobin rather than this, the SNH, yeah, SNO, sticky nitric oxide. Basically, it was very selective. So if the region, let me not misquote, let me remember here. So essentially, if there was no issues with blood flow, it was basically didn't matter. But if there was an issue with blood flow, it was selectively help that region. So it has some sensing mechanism, or the hemoglobin has some sensing mechanism to say, hey, I need to reverse this bond and get rid of this sticky NO. So it can help with blood flow in this region. Now, if humming is that's a fascinating thought. Like, so if we hum, maybe we potentially are getting more sticking to our hemoglobin, and then this is going to help downstream. Perhaps, again, you have to be careful when you talk about scientific studies, but the idea with the humming, you know, is the sterilization too. I didn't even mention that. We didn't talk about that with the nitric oxide. Like, it helps with blood flow, but it's also like antimicrobial, antiviral. And so it really could be beneficial with just killing the virus or viruses in general. So that's one reason to hum. If you feel like, I mean, again, yeah, you just, you never know what's going on. But I remember when COVID was starting and I'd have to go to the grocery store, I'd be humming the whole time. Like, I had no clue if it was working.
Yeah,
it probably didn't. But in any case, it gives you something to feel good about, at least.
Yeah. It's a fun thing to do, isn't it? I really love a good hum. I want to talk about beetroot in a second, but I was just gonna ask you one. Before we go on beetroot. So, one of the oxygen advantage Buteyko exercises is holding your nose and shaking your head, and it unblocks your nose. And I've spoken to the author who we mentioned already, Patrick McKeown, and I think he said something I'm not misquoting this, we don't really know why it unblocks the nose. And I've had my own thoughts around vasodilation and nitric oxide. Any thoughts or any papers, have you seen anything on why a breath hold would unblock a snotty nose or a stuffed up nose?
No, I mean, I've heard Patrick discuss it, you know, and I've thought about it myself. Mm. So I did a personal experiment on this because I thought it's got to be nitric oxide, right? Mm. And so I had a stuffy nose, and okay, we're going to nerd out for a minute. Let's do it. All right. So if when you breathe, so the nasal nitric oxide is being produced and it's in your nasal cavity. So when you inhale, you bring it in. But at the same time, because it's continuously released, when you exhale, you'll wash some of it out. Like, you'll actually breathe some out that's been stored up there. Mm. So there's a great set of papers, one of which was the one with the 10% increase in tissue oxygenation I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Lundberg, I think, is the last name. But they came up with the idea, well, we'll inhale through our nose and exhale through our mouth. Then when we inhale back through our nose again, we have way more nitric oxide getting down into the lungs with each breath. So what I thought, I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. So instead of doing the nose hold and shake my head, I'm going to just, when I have a stuffy nose, I'm going to just breathe in through my nose, out through my mouth, in through my nose to maximize nitric oxide. Mm-hmm. It worked a little. And I mean, again, placebo,
sure.
Who knows? It's me.
Yeah.
I was so excited. So who knows? I don't want to pretend like that's the end all be all, but so it made a little bit of sense to me. I thought, okay, this works. The other thing is, like, we know that sympathetic activation does lead to, like, it does things to make sure your breathing's easier because you need to take in more air. If you're having a stress response, it's expecting you to run. Mm-hmm. I need to breathe more. So it could just be that, you know, there's a host of things that go on when you hold your breath that activate the sympathetic response, and all of that says you're going to need to breathe more. And so whatever the exact mechanism, maybe it's CO2, maybe it's nitric oxide, maybe it's a couple other things we don't know. They're all combining to make sure that next breath is easier. So
Cool. My geeky version, when I had COVID and I was so blocked up, I'll hum a few times quite loud as well, because I'm thinking, right, let's shake as much nitric. So it's and then what I'll do is I'll do a breath hold, and then I'll almost like blow into my nose, and in my head I'm thinking I'm stirring the nitric oxide around.
I love
and again, it.
It
did feel like it made a difference, but then again, maybe it's placebo. I don't know.
Yeah. Who cares, right? It's more fun that way. So yeah, that's awesome.
Beetroot, vasodilations, Viagra, all those sort of things. Thoughts on those? Is it worth drinking beet juice? Is it actually doing anything? I'd love to get your thoughts on some of that stuff as well.
I've never gone too deep down that, but as far as I know, the beet juice, the beetroot and all that has a lot of good evidence behind it. Mm. So I've sampled with like I think it was like a Tim Ferriss podcast. He was sponsored by some beetroot powder, and I started taking it because I was like, oh, that sounds cool. Mm. When I was doing these rucks I was telling you about, where I was walking really long distances. And I definitely noticed an increase in energy, which I guess would be attributed to better blood flow, better oxygenation, things like that. But I do know that like in the exercise science world, there's some good studies on beet and beetroot powder or beetroot or beet juice, all these different things to improve blood flow. And it's working, as far as my understanding, the main mechanism behind it is increasing nitric oxide production. But not in our nasal cavity, like systemically throughout our body. And that's helping with blood flow. But I don't know much beyond that. But I know that lots of athletes use it and it seems to work. Again, maybe there's a slight placebo effect as well, but it seems to work.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I've heard a few bits. Go on, sorry.
There is something to, and again, this is way outside my expertise, but we're just on a podcast having fun, right? But I've seen like one complication of diabetes is microvascular disease. So the small blood vessels and basically becoming damaged. And I remember sometime at some point seeing an argument that increasing nitric oxide, if you don't fix that, if you have microvascular damage, can have like negative effects, where you would think, oh, any type of increased blood flow is good. But they made a good argument for like why you would want to try to address the microvascular damage first. So just something to think about with people. If you ever took a beetroot and felt the opposite effect or felt, uneasy or something, you might think, oh, maybe this is a sign of something else. Again, I'm not a doctor, so I don't know for sure, but I thought, oh, that's interesting, because there's been times where like when I've done humming stuff, it didn't seem to help me as much, and other times it does. And it's like, it could have been that my blood sugars were different and they mess with my, the microvascular side of things. I'm not sure. It's N=1, but anyway, so just something to throw out there.
Interesting. Yeah.
So fascinating. Yeah.
So many different variables going on, isn't there? And it's
right.
Yeah. You're right. You can do the same breathing exercise two different days and feel completely different both days. It's one of the magical things about life, I guess, is like, it's not black and white. So where do we go with this? I've got so many questions I want to ask you about different things. It's tongue posture. Have you gone down the tongue posture route with breathing?
Tongue posture? No, I have. Of course, I've looked into it, but it's my guilty, or not, what's the word? It's the thing I can't force myself to do, no matter how much I learn and how important it is. I try when I'm doing my breathing exercises to keep the tongue against the roof of the mouth. I've read Jaws, the book Jaws, and it gives you a really good reason to do it and all this stuff. But I've never found what I need to read to make it me obsessed with it enough, if that makes sense. I read like crazy. I love reading, so I can read all the time. And it's always like, I do that because I need to hear things a million different ways until someone says something that makes it stick with me. So I know at some point I'll become obsessed with the tongue. So people listening to this, when they check in on me, they might see I'm obsessed because I finally read it in a way that makes sense for me. But as of right now, I encourage people to do it. And then when I lay down or sit down to do a breathing exercise, I generally start like that. So that like to bring my focus in, but throughout the practice, I don't like constantly check in on my tongue posture. Although there's a few people I'm friends with on Instagram who would want to yell at me right now.
Yeah. I'm the same. I'm very tongue tied, so I can't even stick my tongue out really. So the whole tongue thing is just never really, it's not for me, because I can't do anything about it unless I get my tongue snipped, which I'm very reluctant to do at this age. But I'm always fascinated to hear the tidbits about it. But I'm naturally already in the roof of my mouth. There's not much I can do there. It's just kind of stuck though. It's kind of a bit of a natural advantage that it's in a good posture, but at the same time, it's like a problem because it apparently pulls the shoulders forward because of the fascia. Biomechanics, you done much there? Diaphragm, rib cage, any wisdom or studies or anything you can share, diabetic related or just general health related?
You know, I'm not an expert on like all of the intricacies, because some people go really deep on like the rib movement and all this, but I will say that I've looked into at least breathing deeper, whether it's perfect or not. It seems like that is the most important thing. Deep as in not a big breath, but bringing it deeper into your body so that like your abdomen moves and your lower ribs move out and your lower back actually moves out. And there are some pretty crazy things, not specifically to diabetes, but in general, most of the studies, which is another thing to go on a rabbit hole, like the disconnect between the breathing world, people who have become really into breathing and understand these mechanics, but then like the scientific papers, sometimes they just say, hey, do belly breathing, you know, just do diaphragmatic breathing. It's not like they're giving them real detailed, perfect instructional on how to activate their diaphragm. Mm-hmm. They're just saying, hey, breathe into your belly. And we're assuming that's activating the diaphragm more. Mm-hmm. And it still seems to have bukus of benefits. Like I think I mentioned a study about cortisol earlier. There was in that study, they just had people breathe diaphragmatically, breathe through your diaphragm for X number of minutes, like 15 minutes a day for 3 weeks or something. And their cortisol release or reduced. I've seen studies with just telling people to breathe into their belly, right? No perfect mechanics, but it still seemed to really help like reduce oxidative stress, after an endurance event, and help them increase their melatonin production before bed and all these different things. So that instruction of just breathing deeper does something powerful. And there was a more recent study that was fascinating. It took people and had them lay down in an MRI and had them breathe into three different places. They said either breathe into your belly really deep, breathe into your lower ribs, or breathe into your chest. And this was like the three parts of the yogic complete breath. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to test how did these impact cerebral spinal fluid dynamics. So cerebral spinal fluid is this like clear fluid that, delivers nutrients to the brain and removes waste from the brain. And it supplies like cushioning for your spine and for your brain. So it's like really important and, super important for like overall brain health, getting adequate CSF, cerebral spinal fluid flow, so that it can clear all this waste out. In any case, when they breathe deeply into their belly, it increased the flow of this cerebral spinal fluid by 28%, which is crazy. When they breathe into the lower ribs, it was like 23%, and into the chest, it was like 16%, which was statistically insignificant. So based on that, they said basically, you know, the deep abdominal breathing increases the cerebral spinal fluid through your brain more than any other method. And so just interesting, like even if you're not doing it perfect, even if you're not like getting all the exact movements of the ribs and all that, just trying to breathe deeper can be beneficial. It's relaxing, and it can help with the cerebral spinal fluid. So I'm definitely, I'm simplistic as much as a nerd as I am. So like if I'm working with someone, I just say, you know, put a hand on the belly, put a hand on your chest, and let's start there with getting that hand on the belly to move versus the chest. And I know a lot of people, again, will yell at me that I'm friends with even, they would say, no, you got to do the lower ribs and all that, you know? And so I encourage people to go down that rabbit hole all they want. But for me, that's been enough to feel benefits.
Yeah, so beautiful. You know, you said a few minutes ago, you need to hear something in a certain way for it to really register for you. And I'm exactly the same. I've got a lot of friends. By the way, I love a bit of woo woo, so I'm not, you know, and there's actually a great book, isn't it, called Why Woo Woo Works. I've got a lot of friends that love a bit of woo woo breathing, you know, and I like a bit of spirituality as well. But they talk a lot about the spinal fluid. I'm like, but so I think I need to look into that a bit more. So after you've just said it, I'm like, okay, that actually makes more sense now, what you're talking about. So do you know much more about that? Is there like a fluid? Is it in the base? Is it produced somewhere low in it, and it's naturally coming up to the brain, and we're helping like pump it up? What's going on?
Yeah, sort of. So yeah. I don't know where it's produced. That's a great question, but I do know. So, and we'll get a little woo-woo here too. Yeah. That sounds fun. So it goes up your spine during inhalation. So as you bring the air down, the spinal fluid goes up, and as you breathe out, the spinal fluid goes down. And what's interesting, so the reason they say is that there's something going on, I guess, near, you know, in the lower part of your back. And when you inhale, your diaphragm presses down and it increases intra-abdominal pressure, because you're pushing that diaphragm in, and that's actually increasing intra-abdominal pressure. And this pushes the fluid up. It like acts as like a pump. Yeah, kind of like it pushes it up. And then when you relax the diaphragm and it comes back up, that intra-abdominal pressure goes down, and then it falls back into it. And there's a book called Spinal Breathing Pranayama, which I was like, I'm just going to read this for myself. I'm never going to tell anyone I read it, because I already knew it was like super woo-woo sounding. But they have you, and this is, you know, an ancient technique. They have you trace your spine upward during inhalation, and then to your brow here, right between your eyebrows, and then downward during exhalation. And I thought, it's so weird. It doesn't make sense. Like, the air is going down. So I wanted to trace it down and then trace it back up. But, it was like coincident that I just happened to read the paper right after reading that book. And I thought, what the hell? That's exactly what the spinal fluid's doing, is it's going up during inhalation and down during exhalation. Somehow these ancient yogis figured out, you know, that's how we should be tracing our spine. During inhalation, we should trace it up. Exhalation, in our mind's eye, like trace it, just, you know, in your imagination, so to speak. But nonetheless, pretty neat stuff. And that's as much as I know about the topic, to be honest. Yeah,
you've intrigued me now. I'm gonna have to go on a little rabbit hole now looking at this. There's a breathing technique called like spinal breathing, where people, I think they're typically like, this is what I've seen, it's like, and the kind of movement. Have you seen anything to do with that?
I've never seen that
one. No, okay.
I mean, I'm blown away every day by the number of breathing techniques. Thousands, you know, there's so much. Thousands, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, incredible.
And I know each of them have a purpose. So I like, yeah, exactly. Just find the right one for you and get at it.
I say there's nothing new in breathing, isn't there? So there's no new breathing techniques out there. They've all been done thousands of years ago.
It's so true. And it's like, as far as I've come with breathing, actually where I'm at now, I go backwards. Like, I keep going backwards. Like, I'm just obsessed with mindfulness of breathing now. Like, I don't even want to change it. I just want to notice it. Like, you know, and to me, it's like meditation. Obviously that's like, you know, mindfulness of meditation, or mindful meditation technique is just to observe your breath. But it just all comes back to like the simplest things. It's like, oh, why even do a breathing technique when I can just notice my breathing, or just follow it and get all these crazy benefits. And so I go back and forth with going backwards to like the basics. Like, just breath awareness can be so profound. And you start reading about it and learning that, like, you know, this is where it all began, was just awareness of the breath can be a gateway to everything, to enlightenment, all these different things. And so, I don't know where I was going with that, other than that, you know, sometimes going backwards, forward, you know, there's just so many techniques. Yeah, we were talking about techniques. So it's like, there's so many techniques, but sometimes just the simplest thing, just observing your breath, can be so, you know, powerful.
Yeah, that's always where I start with people. It's like, let's just sense the breath before we make any changes.
Right.
And I often say it's like one of the hardest breathing techniques, because the minute you start to pay attention, you want to start to change things, or you think, you start judging yourself, and it's really hard. Right. And so for me, there's a lot of practice of just observing. And even now, you start, oh, maybe I'm breathing a bit too chesty, or a little bit too fast. Uh-huh. I'm just trying to observe. Do you do anything around visualizations? This is something I've started to get very interested in recently. And So for example, with coherence breathing, I'll do just a lot of, say, counting, but somebody guided me through it the other day, and they were using like the white light coming in, and it's being wrapped around the heart and all these beautiful, and it was really pleasant. But I don't know if there's any scientific benefits to any of this, like a visualization of the breath or a color. Have you gone down that route at all?
I've never, from a scientific perspective, no, but I will say there's lots of, not lots, I know of a few, I should say, techniques that do something like that, right? They visualize some sort of ball or energy or something coming in and out. There's like the ancient Tibetan techniques that would like visualize like you exhaling like this like black sud type stuff. Like, so there's gotta be something to it, right? If these ancient traditions came up with it. But I don't know enough about it. I do personally use some visualization stuff, after learning about it from, Herbert Benson, who is a Harvard, physician who discovered the relaxation response. So he's the one that like basically set the foundation for all breathing, by discovering our body's relaxation parasympathetic response. He has a technique called remembered wellness. That just, again, resonated with me. I thought, I was thinking of something else there. He describes it basically as reminding yourself of like healthy states, like when you felt great, and visualizing times when like you were at your best and stuff. And so what he's saying is like, you can access these neuro signatures of health and wellness because they've already happened in your body, and you're just kind of like reigniting them. And the way he says it, it's very scientific, and he used it with, you know, tons of, I'm sure thousands and thousands of people he worked with. And so it really just like struck a chord with me, like, oh, this makes so much sense. So I do some of that. And I've tried the spinal breathing where I visualize my spine. I try anything I read. I try at least once just so I can speak to it from a level of like, well, I take that back. I haven't tried holotropic breathing, but anything I can do by myself, I try. And so I think there's something to be said about the visualization thing. But I don't know what, like, I don't know what it adds. You know, there's tons of evidence of visualization for sports. Like if you, or they call it mental rehearsal. So like actually going through the steps of what you're going to do can be extremely beneficial. The problem is like, if you fantasize, then you don't get the benefit. So if you're just like, oh, you just picture yourself winning, and that's all you ever picture, you're never going to win. But if you picture yourself going through the motions and doing the steps, it actually really helps your performance. And so balancing that, I don't know where that would come into play with the breathing visualizations, but I'm sure there's something there, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Oh yeah. Cause it's so, yeah, I heard something similar about like, if you tell people about something you're going to do, it takes a lot of power away. So for example, if I say, oh, I'm going to run a marathon, you're like, oh, good for you. I get that reward mechanism, and then I don't need to run the marathon. So it just reminded me of that a little bit. Like if I just picture winning, maybe it doesn't give us interest. Okay. Let's, I'm conscious of your time. So I want to just talk a little bit, if it's okay, about vagal toning, the vagus nerve. And if you know much about the whole coherence, resonant breathing thing, because, I know about the heart rate variability increase, and I've read so many things about coherence breathing, such as, you know, the diaphragm is like a second pump to the heart, and if we engage the diaphragm properly, it takes some pressure off the heart. Blood flow starts to change if we start to pump the heart differently. The brain waves start to change. There's folklore that we used to breathe at 5.5 breaths thousands of years ago. We've just been getting faster and faster ever since. So I don't know if you could talk a bit about coherence breathing benefits. You're doing a longer one, so you said 4-4-6. Vagus nerve, the whole thing is just it's just fascinating to me, but I just find it so overwhelming. There just seems to be so much here. People talk about the vagus nerve, the wandering nerves, do all these switching off and on, and so there's quite a lot there. So let me try and make that as simple question. Talk a bit about the vagal tone in the vagus nerve, and if you can, a bit about coherence breathing and how it links.
Sure, yeah, I'll do my best. I might confuse you more because all of it confuses me too. But so the vagus nerve is like the primary nerve, or nerves, there's two of them, of your parasympathetic nervous system. So when it gets stimulated, when it's active more, it relieves it, it leads to relaxation. It does all these, it's the relaxation response. It reduces blood pressure, it improves blood flow, it lowers inflammation, it does all these great things. It calms the heart rate, and it calms your mind. So when people talk about, you know, breathing techniques and being relaxing, it's generally thought that all, most of the benefits come through that vagus nerve. That the other part about it is about, they estimate that about 80% of it is sending information to the brain, mm-hmm. and about 20% is being carried away from the brain. So a lot of times we think of the brain as like a top down, our brain thinks and sends all these messages, but it gets a lot of messages too. Mm-hmm. And so the vagus nerve is mainly taking information from our body and sending it back up to our brain. And when you breathe slowly and deeply, it sends these signals to the brain that everything's all right, man. Like, we're good. You don't need to stress anymore. Stop worrying so much like you always are, because you're human, right? And so it tells everything to calm down. And then the brain gets that message and says, oh, I'm supposed to calm down. I'm going to send this message back out to everything else. And so it's kind of like this bottom up to top down mechanism. And so that is why this, the vagus nerve gets so much attention in the breathing community. And it's so important. We know that slow breathing does seem to activate it. The way we measure if this vagus nerve is active is generally non-invasively, it's indirectly. So we would say heart rate variability is a marker of your vagus nerve. So if you have higher, or vagus tone, I should say. And so if you have higher heart rate variability, that generally means that your vagus nerve is working better. It's more active. And that means you have a higher vagal tone most of the time. And so that's one way to measure it. And then there's heart rate variability is really confusing. I've never understood it fully. Like, there's so many different ways to measure heart rate variability. There's the time domain and the frequency domain. The only thing I can say about it is that there's one frequency domain measurement called low frequency heart rate variability. And that one, if you're breathing slowly, is a good marker of the vagus nerve. It actually seems to be measuring activation of the vagus nerve, because they've done a nice study where they gave a parasympathetic nervous system blockade. So they took a drug that like basically shut down the parasympathetic nervous system. And then they took a different drug that shut down the sympathetic nervous system. And they had people do slow breathing and they measured heart rate variability. And they were able to basically tease out that low frequency measurement is showing us vagus nerve activity, because they did this exclusion using these drugs. So that's how we can measure it. And at slow breathing frequencies. So when we breathe slowly and we send these messages, our heart rate variability does go up. You kind of hit on all the benefits. Blood pressure goes down. It relieves a little pressure on the heart. The heart gets more efficient. Blood flow is more efficient. But it's all, we think it's all mediated through the vagus nerve. That's only partially true though. So I recently found a really cool study it was 2022. So it was just about a year ago now. And what they said is, well, we're going to put this to the test because we actually think that the brain wave changes plays a huge role in these benefits. It's not just, they say the vagus nerve is clearly important, but there's a lot going on with the brain. So, and they said with the nose specifically. So they took people and had them do slow breathing through their nose only or through their mouth only. And they measured their brainwave activity and they asked them a bunch of psychological questionnaires based like to assess their relaxation and stuff. What they found was that the heart rate variability went up equally, whether you were mouth breathing or slow breathing. Mm-hmm. As long as you were breathing slowly, the heart rate variability went up statistically the same. So if it was just the vagus nerve, then they should have had equal outcomes on everything. But when they breathe through their nose versus through their mouth on the EEG signature, so the brainwave measurements, it was insane. Like the nasal breathing led to increased connectivity across all these different brain regions in the brain. It's a pretty mind-blowing picture. If people are interested, it is on my Instagram. I can't remember the exact date. Maybe we can find it, put it in the show notes, but I have a picture of it because it's so crazy. And so the brain changes were significantly different in the nasal versus the mouth breathing group. The nasal group also felt less physical tension, less psychological tension, less anxiety. They felt like a heightened sense of focused, but relaxed. So they weren't stressed. They just were like, I feel good, right? It was like this, they called it an altered state of consciousness, basically, more of that. And so essentially the conclusion was like, yes, the vagus nerve is important, which it is, but there's also these brain waves. So there's just so much going on. And so it's the nasal stimulation, that constant nasal stimulation of the olfactory bulb that changes the brain waves that leads to these really positive states we experience with breathing. So it's not just slow breathing. It's not just the vagal tone. It's nasal, slow nasal breathing, which gets you both, like the brain changes and the vagus nerve changes. And that kind of combines into this like nice symphony of feeling amazing.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, that's very cool. Oh, thank you for sharing that. I know people are going to gobble that up. So I'm a dyslexic, so I really struggle with like papers and all that sort of stuff. So how, have you got any like techniques for like me and people that are watching this that want to learn more about scientific papers? I know you do some book summaries. So we can talk a bit about that as well. Do you do scientific paper summaries as well? Do you?
Yeah.
Okay. Talk a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. I have a website called breathlearning.com. And it's the name of the idea is it's the Breath is Life Learning Center. And it's basically just a place for people who either are like coaches, if like you're a breathing coach or a yoga coach, anyone who incorporates breathing, or if you're just like obsessed with it and you really like to learn, it's to try to do that, to make everything simple, inspiring, fun. And so I review books and scientific papers and basically create a really short summary and podcast of each one. So for example, like that paper, the reason I can rehearse some, you know, it sounds pretty rehearsed, but I just stated to you is because I summarized that paper and I read a podcast about it and I made a video about it. So it's very fresh on my mind. But that's basically what it is. It's a place for people to learn. I send out an email every day, which is about, you know, 10 to 30 seconds to read. It's just like a short quote, something to inspire people, to remind them how powerful our breathing is. And then every week I give you either a book review or a paper review and I alternate them. So like, today's Wednesday, on Friday, I'll be sending out a book review to the members. And then the following Friday, I'll be another science review. And it's just, for me, it was just a way to like live what I said earlier, like, you know, focusing more on principles, less on methods. Like I review the Oxygen Advantage, I review Wim Hof, I review any method, holotropic breathing, and so that people can pick and choose what they like from it, and not have to know all the science. Like, hopefully I get lots of great feedback from people that like the science reviews are really beneficial. They're structured in a way to basically give you a little bit of introduction so you understand why the study was done, what the study did, just the, you know, the bare minimum you need to improve your life. What were the results? And then like, how could you apply with what you just learned? Is there any way to apply this in your life? And here's my suggestion. Like, look, hey, this study did this, or like the nasal one, like just breathe through your nose. It's super simple. Like it doesn't always have to be complicated or technical. So that's the Breath is Life Learning Center, which is breathlearning.com. It's just the daily email, book summaries and science summaries. It's a massive resource right now, and I just hope to grow it to like be this hub of all breathing information and mindfulness. So I talk about breathing and mindfulness. It's kind of, they go hand in hand. So it's not all breath work. A lot of it's like full catastrophe living and pieces every breath from Thich Nhat Hanh and studies on breath awareness, like mindful breath awareness and how that impacts our impulsivity and things like that. So there's lots of variety. There's fast breathing, there's breath holds, there's slow breathing. So I try to be pretty open to all of it, but it's definitely biased toward my obsession with the slower stuff. So
very keep cool. Okay. Well, you've got a new member straight away after this. And so if people watch and listen, I'm going to put the links to that. So it's breathlearning.com.
Yep. Breathlearning.com.
Yep, so we'll put that down there. That sounds incredible. Because I'll often pull up a study and I'm just like, this is why I love doing podcasts, because my brain just learns this way and I get to speak to wonderful people like you. You put a black and white document in front of me and I just hear static and I'm just like, shh. And so it's just, it's really hard. And so I have been using a bit of ChatGPT recently, and I'll paste a study in and go, can you summarize it for me? And that's been quite helpful, but still, you don't know if ChatGPT is like messing about with it a little bit. So you got to be extra careful there. So thank you. That's ace. Okay. Question before we finish off. Got a friend who is a free diver breath holder. He was the first guy to break the 10 minute breath mark, Tom Zitas. So wow. He held 10 minutes, no oxygen, huffing, pure natural. Have you come across any studies about how to increase your breath holds? When you, not for the average person like me, but like for somebody like that, have you seen anything so far from any of your research that helps people like push those limits, these like superhumans?
I know. I mean, to me, that would be all, I would go straight to the mind. Like I wouldn't even worry about physiology at that point. Like if you're holding your breath for 10 minutes, I would think you'd have to learn some sort of like mental coping mechanism to ignore the pain and to, you know, just persist beyond. I mean, he's already clearly gone there. So I don't know. That's insane. I would think at that point there's a different new technique isn't going to help as much as like a physiological, like sprinting or with a breath hold, you know, all those things probably are out the door at that point. If you're at 10 minutes breaking world records, you know, you're probably in need of something deep for the mind, like
that's useful
to take you to another place, you know.
Yeah, that's really useful, because I'm thinking like, oh, maybe he needs to do some humming before, maybe get some extra of that extra sticky nitric oxide in the blood now.
But again, if it gives him the placebo, right? If he thinks, I found this, I can't tell you how many times I've done something stupid that probably doesn't work, but because I truly thought it did, right, it did. But in any case, I don't know enough about the placebo effect to be talking about it intelligently, but I do know the mind though, you know, the endurance events. I mentioned I've walked, you know, I've done a couple 50 milers. I've walked 100 miles for this other thing. And I became super interested in endurance events, and all that is mental. Like you get to a point like where there's no amount of training that, and when you're at 80 miles, like it's all in your head. Like, can I force my body to go? And so I can only imagine. Tell them to read some David Goggins books, right?
Yes. Yeah. I've not read the second one yet, but I've read the first one many times. It's I did the Camino, by the way. Have you ever heard of the Camino in Spain? It's like a big walk.
Oh, I have. Yes, I have.
Yeah. And I had I had 20 kilogram backpack because I'm an idiot, and I packed everything I didn't need. I had like one of these big phone batteries that was like 500 miles over 30 days. So, and it was mental at the end because my body was just like exhausted. I remember wanting to give up a few times, but I didn't know any of the breathing stuff really back then. So I'm a bit gutted. Need to go again, but I am gonna like do. I've been thinking of. It's funny you should say that. I've been thinking about getting some 2 liter water bottles and filling them with water and just put them in my backpack and then going for a walk with that. I was thinking about that extra because I think I mentioned before we hit record, I've got a baby and he's getting heavier every day. He's already at 10 kilograms now. I'm like, shit, I don't know if my back's gonna be able to handle this in like 5 years, you know. So probably need to do some rucking to get some extra.
They say that rucking was like a established. Well, I shouldn't say they say. I follow Michael Easter, who wrote the book The Comfort Crisis. It's a really good book, but he kind of popularized rucking, which is really neat to see, like bringing it to the masses. But he mentioned somewhere that like that's a big benefit of carrying babies is like it's that weight, like it. And so similar with the rucksack, it's like kind of an adaptation. They used to put babies on their back. They would do whatever they could to carry them long distances, right? And so when we ruck, we kind of mimic that that evolutionary skill we had. Yeah, it's pretty neat.
I see some of these young, because I'm an older dad, but I see some of these younger mums and they're half the size of me. They're dead skinny and holding like a 7-year-old in one arm. I was like, how are you doing that? But I guess you've had this gradual weight every day for 7 years, just getting a little bit heavier, and you've just kind of got used to it anyway. Got a couple of cheesy questions to finish us off.
Sure.
I'm interested to get your answer on this. If you could recommend one book to somebody about breathing, what comes to mind?
About breathing,
it doesn't have to be just anything.
Breathing. I mean, that's such a good question, because it depends on where they're at, but right, because every book.
Yeah.
So I would say for breathing, though, one of the most enjoyable for me to read is The Healing Power of the Breath by Richard Brown and Patricia Gerbarg.
Mm-hmm.
If they like audio, there's a book called Breathing, The Master Key to Healing by Andrew Weil, Dr. Andrew Weil. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorites, but it's only an audio tape. It's not an actual physical book. So I love that one. And I think it's one of the most practical introductions to breathing. But if you like a physical book, check out The Healing Power of the Breath. That's my answer today. Tomorrow might be different, but that's today.
Beautiful. Thank you. And if you got stuck on a desert island and you could only bring one breathing technique with you for a year, what would that be?
A year. Mindful breathing, I guess. Breathing. Yeah, I would like to say slow breathing, but if I only had, that might get boring. Mindful breathing never gets boring because it's all the mind, right?
And define that for us. What does that mean to you, mindful breathing? Is that a specific technique or
just being mindful of breathing sensations, just observing it. So I guess you could. So I practice it with slow breathing. I do slow mindful breathing or mindful slow breathing. So I guess I could say that mindful slow breathing. Slow breathing technique. Let's say 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out.
Yeah.
But with the added benefit of you know, watching it with my mind, and when my mind wanders, bringing it back to the sensations. Mm-hmm. When my mind wanders, bringing it back to sensations. Mm-hmm. So that'd be my answer.
And then the last question, breath work's like a really loaded term and it means so many different things to different people. But what does breath work mean to you as a word or as a term or philosophy?
I would say, I mean, just the first thing that comes to mind is just like the conscious use of our breath to help us in achieve whatever we want to achieve, whatever outcome it is, whatever it might be. So I'm actually not a huge fan of the word breath work. I try not to use it much. So it's hard for me to, the first thing that comes to mind is like, oh, I don't like it, but I do love what it represents. Like I love, it represents just people caring about the breath. So to me, it represents like the fact that we're all being conscious of this power. So just the idea that we can consciously manipulate our breath to get a desired outcome.
Yeah, it's a funny word, isn't it? Because like there's a video on YouTube, actually, it's got millions of views, and it's a couple doing breath work, and they're like, guys, it's called breath work for a reason, because it is work. And then they start huffing and puffing for like 20 minutes, and I'm like, that does feel like work, whereas when you're doing like coherence breathing, that doesn't feel like work to me. That's it's just effortless, you know, it's relaxing. Yeah. So yeah, I know what you mean by that word. It's a bit of a weird word, putting the word work at the end of breath. Yeah, I'm not sure what the roots of that are, but interesting. Mate, thank you so much, that's been fascinating. Is there anything we haven't covered that you wanted to cover?
No, I mean, this is amazing. I will throw out for people with diabetes, I'm working on an app. It's called the Breathing App for Diabetes. So keep an eye out for that. I do have a website, thebreathingdiabetic.com. Mm-hmm. That's like my main site, where I just have like a newsletter and things. So if they're interested in that, they could sign up there. And then whenever it comes out, I'll be sending out lots, or follow me on Instagram. I'll mention it there. But if you do have diabetes, I have a program. I have things you can do now, but there's an app coming out hopefully in the next few months that will be like a 28-day program guiding them through all of these different things with the science, the breathing exercises. So check that out.
Cool. So yeah, let me know when that comes out, and I'll do a shout out separately for that as well.
Oh,
to
cool.
People.
Thanks, yeah.
Awesome. And yeah, and I'll link everything down below. So again, watching, listening, all the links down below, go and check everything out. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. That was a load of fun, and I really got to geek out. I needed a good breath geek out. It's been a while actually since I've done one of these. So thank you very much.
Thank you,
mate.
Mike. Yeah, and, really appreciate
it. Yeah, everyone, hope you enjoyed the podcast, and we'll see you on the next one. Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you for sticking all the way through to the end. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. There's literally a million things that you could be doing with your time right now. And the fact that you gave it to this conversation, I really want to thank you for that, because your attention is super, super valuable. And I hope you got a lot of value from this. If you did, please consider sharing this podcast with a friend or a family member or a colleague. And if you haven't done so, just a reminder, grab that free PDF that I've got, my 7 favorite breathing exercises, super simple exercises that you can just click on, It plays them through YouTube and you can just practice different things, getting to sleep, reducing stress, firing ourselves up. So that's just a really quick thing. It's a bit of value that I can give you as a bit of a thank you. And it means that you can kind of just get some practice in on some of these different techniques that are out there as well. And finally, I just wanted to mention that I am open to breath coaching. I only take on a couple of clients each month because it's very bespoke. So I'm looking for you, if you're the type of person that is high performance, that is very driven and wants to work on themselves and knows that there's something isn't quite right. Maybe there's a little bit too much stress, maybe there's a bit of anxiety. Maybe you can see burnouts a couple of stations away. Whatever it is, athletic performance, then it's worth having a free breath consultation with me. I do a complimentary 45-minute set on YouTube. And we can really have a chat and just see if the breath coaching is a good fit for you or not. And what I'll do is I'll take some breath measurements with you, work out exactly where your breathing is right now. We'll run a number of tests, get the tape measure out, measure your diaphragm and your rib cage. And then we'll look at your goals. Where are you trying to get to? What are those things? Let's try and crystallize those goals. And then off the back of that, if we think there's a really good fit there, then we can talk about my 6-week coaching package. And my goal is to shortcut everything for you because you can go and listen to all 100 of my podcasts. You can read 50 books on breathing, or we can spend 6 weeks together, an hour a week, and I'll help you get where you need to get to a lot quicker. So if that sounds like something that you might be interested in, you can click below to apply. It's a very limited number of spots. I'm really look forward to meeting some of you. And if it's not for you right now, then don't forget on this YouTube channel, there's over 300 videos. We've got 100 interviews with the world's top breathing experts and 250 breathing exercises for you just to try or categorize beginner, expert, all those different things. So what you can do next, you can try this breathing exercise here, or you might want to try this podcast here. I think that'll be quite useful for you. Thank you so much for being with Take a Deep Breath, and I'll see you on one of these or the complimentary breath consultation. Cheers.